During the first week of the 2017 session of the Kentucky General Assembly, the House and Senate approved and the governor signed 7 bills, including right-to-work legislation and 2 controversial bills regarding abortion. This historic activity and the entire session were a result of the November election, which left the Senate in the control of Republicans, as well as the governor's office, with the addition of the state's House for the first time in 96 years.
I'm most proud of our members and how we came in and have gone to work to try and do some good policy, and I think we have here.
On this week's Eastern Standard, we'll hear more from House Speaker Jeff Hoover, as well as our panel of reporters gathered around our table. We're interested in your questions or comments about the just-completed 2017 session. Write to us by email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Post your comment to the website or the Facebook page, or send a tweet at WEKUEST. In a little while, we'll open the phones as well. It's time for Eastern Standard, right after the latest news from NPR. From the studios of WEKU on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University, this is Eastern Standard. Hello, I'm John Hingsbergen. Pleased to welcome to our roundtable a group of reporters that you may be familiar with who've been with us a number of times before. And we think it's appropriate for us to do a post-General Assembly session roundtable with our guests, Adam Beam of the Associated Press, Ronnie Ellis of CNI, did I have it right here? Newspapers.
Yes, CNHI.
CHI, excuse me. Get my alphabet soup correct. And, of course, Ryland Barton, State House reporter for Kentucky Public Radio. Ryland, thanks for being with us as well.
Hey, John.
We are going to start off the program by doing a little something to refresh our memory. Some of our listeners may have heard this story on our air on WEKU just yesterday, produced by Ryland, about the just-ended General Assembly session. But let me remind you that our program is an interactive show. We're going to talk about the General Assembly and its accomplishments under the first time with a Republican Senate, Republican governor, and a Republican House in 96 years. Yes. We're going to talk about that what your impressions and observations and maybe your questions after we get rolling here. But first up, lawmakers transformed the legal landscape of Kentucky during this year's General Assembly. The state has new laws restricting abortions and allowing charter schools. Legislators also passed pro-business measures that forbid mandatory union dues and add a hurdle for people suing doctors and hospitals for malpractice. Capitol reporter Ryland Barton provided this report on what passed the General Assembly and how the new laws might affect Kentuckians.
On the last day of the legislative session, Governor Matt Bevin walked up to the state Senate and thanked lawmakers for their work, which was for the most part in lockstep with the governor's agenda.
This has been a transformative session. Kentucky is better for it. We've put seeds in the ground that are going to germinate over time. And as we get older and our kids and grandkids grow up, we'll be able to look back on the 2017 session and be amazed at the things you've set in motion.
Both chambers and the General Assembly were controlled by Republicans for the first time in state history this year, and they flexed their political will by passing bills that never had a chance under Democratic control.
It proves that elections have consequences.
This is Senate Majority Floor Leader Damon Thayer, a Republican from Georgetown.
Over the last few election cycles, the people of Kentucky have sent a message that they wanted a new direction for this Commonwealth. And it wasn't always easy, Mr. President, but save for a handful of bills, you can truly say about this session, promises made, promises kept.
Kentucky is now a so-called right-to-work state, meaning companies can't force workers to pay union dues in order to get a job. Though opponents of the concept say it lowers wages, supporters say right-to-work makes Kentucky more competitive for companies looking to relocate or expand in Kentucky. House Speaker Jeff Hoover credited the law for the announcement that Amazon will be investing $1.5 billion to create an air hub at the Cincinnati Airport in northern Kentucky. Economic Development Cabinet Secretary Terry Gill made a similar claim about a yet-to-be-revealed company that's looking to invest in eastern Kentucky.
It is a result of the improving business climate in the state.
Lawmakers voted to set aside $15 million in bonds to help attract that mystery project on the last day of the legislative session. The legislature also voted to allow charter schools to apply to open up in Kentucky as soon as this fall. Charters have been controversial because they'll be exempted from most state regulations but still use state funding. Supporters say the institutions will better educate students. Here's Kentucky Education Commissioner Stephen Pruitt.
It won't be the silver bullet. They won't be the panacea.
but they can be something. And I've personally seen how they've done some really great things for kids that maybe didn't fit in the natural and normal environment.
Students will be allowed to enroll in charter schools located within their school districts. A lottery will be set up if too many students apply. The legislature also passed a handful of bills to restrict abortions in the state. Here's Senate floor leader Damon Thayer again.
In Kentucky, we value life from conception on. We are now one of the most pro-life states in the United States.
Governor Bevin signed new laws that ban abortions after the 20th week in pregnancy and put Planned Parenthood at the back of the line for federal funding, a new law requiring doctors to conduct and describe ultrasounds on women seeking abortions has already been challenged in federal court. Meanwhile, the state's only abortion provider is suing to stay open after the state health cabinet threatened to shut it down. House Speaker Hoover says he doesn't have any disappointments as the first Republican to preside over the chamber in nearly a century.
There was more significant legislation passed in the 2017 session than in any session in recent memory.
Governor Bevin says he wants to call a special legislative session this year for lawmakers to hammer out a tax reform plan that might include tax increases. Republican legislators have been slow to throw their support behind the concept. I'm Ryland Barton in Frankfort.
And this is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. I'm John Hingsberg, and Ryland Barton is with us in the studio, as is Ronnie Ellis and Adam Beam. And we're here to talk about the just-ended session of the General Assembly, and we're interested in interacting with you about it. If you have questions, comments, stories that you'd like to share, please feel free to call us at 800-621-8890. Write to us by email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Send a tweet at wekuest. And always feel free to post on the Facebook page or the WEKU website at weku.fm. And gentlemen, let's get started. Actually, let me acknowledge, we will hear from House Speaker Jeff Hoover in the second segment of our program. Speaker Hoover was in Richmond a few weeks ago before the session ended, and I had an opportunity to sit down and chat with him a little bit. It was the week after we did our show live from Frankfort, and he had been unavailable for that show. So we did have a conversation with him, and we'll share a part of that in just a few minutes. But major accomplishments of this 2017 General Assembly. Ryland, thank you for that summary report, and the timing was perfect. It came in just in time to air yesterday and for us to use this morning.
Glad it worked out.
Yes.
The main thrust of this legislative session happened in the first 7 days of the legislative session. The first 5 days. Passed a right to work bill forbidding mandatory union dues. Passed a couple anti-abortion measures and passed a bill that kind of paved the way for the governor's actions at the University of Louisville Board of Trustees to, I guess, lawmakers feel like there's some legal clarity on that issue now. This is the first time in state history that the legislature was controlled, that both chambers were controlled by Republicans, plus having the added bonus of a Republican governor as well. And they were able to really pass a whole lot of bills that never had a chance of passing when Democrats controlled any of the chambers or had the governor's mansion.
Ronnie Ellis.
Well, I think Ryland has summed it up pretty well. It was the year of the Republican, and they came in promising certain types of legislation, and by and large, I think they produced them and passed them. I don't think there were a whole lot of surprises, perhaps a couple of minor surprises at the end when they did not pass a bill that would have limited the powers of Attorney General Andy Beshear. Other than that, I don't think there were a couple of things that I thought would pass that didn't, but they haven't gone away. They will be studied in the interim and be brought back next year.
What were the vetoes, the vetoes that were overridden? Were there four of them?
There were four.
There were four bills that the governor vetoed. All four are law, regardless. One was a road naming bill. It's passed every year. The governor didn't like it because it apparently deviated from transportation cabinet policy, and that it named a road not after a person or an historical event. It named a trail called the
Copperhead
yeah. Trail. It's supposed to be a tourism thing for motorcycles. He didn't like that. They overrode that. There was a bill that regulated drones. you said you couldn't basically be charged with a felony if you're flying drones in a prohibited area. He vetoed that. There was a bill that was called Tim's Law that had to do with mental health. It basically allowed a judge to order someone with mental illness to go into outpatient treatment. He vetoed that. And then he also vetoed a portion of a revenue bill that would have – there's a – you know, Kentucky was one of several states that got a lot of money from Volkswagen. If you remember, Volkswagen had a settle – you know, they had trouble because they were – their cars – they were cheating the emissions test for their cars. And Kentucky got, I think, was it like $100 million?
Yeah, something like that.
Something like that. And so the legislature put a paragraph in that law that said, hey, by the way, you can't spend this money unless we say it's okay. And the governor vetoed that, and the legislature overrode that.
I mean, wouldn't that fall within normal constitutional requirements for budgeting and so forth?
Well, you think so, but I think this governor has shown that he is willing to do things like that. I mean, you know, he ordered to cut the budgets of the university, public colleges and universities that the legislature had allocated and given them that money, and he told them he couldn't spend it, and the Supreme Court had to come in and say that he couldn't do that. And so I think the fact that the legislature might felt that, hey, we want to we want to protect this money in the case, just in case the governor decides he wants to go spend it.
They've also been annoyed, to put it lightly, about some court settlements through the Attorney General's office that directed the spending, and they wanted to make clear, you know, somewhat this is reserving their separation of power to be the appropriations body.
The issue of the powers of the Attorney General that did not move forward at the end of this session, is that still something that we're expecting will come back? I recall hearing some conjecture somewhere along the line that legislators are going to think about that and perhaps bring that back next year.
I think it'll come back in some form. I'm not entirely certain in which. This started out as a bill simply to put some limits on the percentage of contingency fees that the AG could offer outside firms because of their expertise and experience pursue these massive litigation cases like Volkswagen or some of the suits against drug companies that were manufacturing OxyContin and others. But then Governor Bevin wanted it to go further and to transfer some of the AG's powers to him. That didn't happen in the House, but it did in the Senate, or at least an attempt was made. That amendment by Senate President Robert Stivers was never voted on. On the last day, he came back with a second amendment, which basically put the power to file an amicus brief, which is a friend of the court brief, but the point is it kind of establishes the position of Kentucky, the state, in some of these high-profile cases like abortion cases. And they wanted that transferred to the governor. Passed the Senate. I think there were some internal Republican politics involved in what happened in the House. Not only did it not pass, but I think there was some I think they used it as some opportunity to show that they would not be dominated, that they would retain their independence.
We'll take a short break and get back to our Eastern Standard program, a Reporters Roundtable. We're talking about the just-ended 2017 General Assembly. We have with us Adam Beam, Ronnie Ellis, and Ryland Barton. And you're welcome to join in with your question, comment, or story, WEKU Eastern Standard at gmail.com. Send us a tweet at WEKU EST, or get on the phone. We'd be glad to have your voice on the air, 800-621-8890. It's Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations, live on Thursday morning, a Reporters Roundtable. We have with us Ryland Barton, Ronnie Ellis, and Adam Beam to discuss the just-ended 2017 session of the Kentucky General Assembly, and we're interested in your questions. If you have questions for the reporters or your observations about the General Assembly and the accomplishments of Kentucky's legislators during this session under complete Republican control for the first time in a long, long time. Was there ever a time when all branches, all of the government, the Senate, the House, and the executive branch were Republican
controlled? No, this is the first time in state history, and actually it's the first time in state history that both legislative chambers were controlled by Republicans as well.
So a few weeks back, before the session ended, actually, I guess it was in the What do we call that period between when they take off for 2 or 3 weeks?
There's the veto period. Are you talking about
the break? The earlier,
they just call it an interim.
The interim. Okay, during the interim. Well, House Speaker Jeff Hoover, who was new as the Speaker of the House this year, he had been the minority leader, I guess, for a number of years. He was in Richmond, and we had an opportunity to chat, as I mentioned earlier in the program. And I want to share with you a segment of that interview. Much of what we talked about that day, we talked for 15-20 minutes or so. Much was about speculation about what might happen during the final couple of days of the General Assembly. But in just a few minutes' time, we talked a little bit about accomplishments and his startup as Speaker of the House.
Well, I'm very proud of the fact that we are now in the majority. It's been a long battle. When I first became Republican floor leader back in 2001, we had 36 members. A long way from the majority. And we've made steady gains over the years. And then a result of redistricting and some other things, you know, we would drop back down into the mid to upper 30s after getting in the mid 40s. But after November the 8th, to become the majority is just a testament to a lot of work by a lot of people over many years of getting us in a position to become the majority. Obviously, it was historic for the first time in 96 years to have a Republican majority, but I'm most proud of our members and how we came in and have gone to work to try and do some good policy, and I think we have here.
Following the election in November, did you, President of the Senate, Stivers, and the governor get together and discuss your agenda for the legislative session this year?
Well, what really happened after November the 8th election, we had a caucus meeting in Frankfort 2 days later on November the 10th, and I was trying to lay out to our caucus members, now 64 supermajority, 23 of those were brand new, just got elected. And as I was telling them, there are a lot of things that we've got to get done, going from the opposition party for almost 100 years to now the governing party of having responsibility and duty to govern.
That first week of the 2017 General Assembly was a busy one, a lot of activity, and a Saturday session as well. 7 bills went through the House and the Senate and were signed that weekend by the governor. Was that something that you, Governor Bevin, and President Stivers had decided you would do to kind of show, make a point and show folks some productivity?
Well, I began after November the 10th, John, of telling folks, you know, we are going to go slow. We're going to try and be deliberate. This idea and responsibility of governing was new to us because we'd always been in the minority. But about the first middle part of December, President Stivers and I began having discussions of maybe what we could do that first week and started talking with the governor. Never before in the history of Kentucky had any bill passed, not one bill had ever passed the first week of a legislative session. So we decided to be ambitious. We knew what we wanted to get done. We knew that on those issues, by and large, people know how they're going to vote, whether you're talking about right to work or repeal of prevailing wage or pro-life issues or transparency in the pension system. We knew people knew how they were going to vote. We could debate for 30 days and no votes would change. So we decided, let's go in and let's get some significant things done the first week. And on our side in the House, we hadn't even chosen committee chairs, and we didn't do that till the second week in December. And so then we had to start working with those committee chairs over Christmas and the holiday season to say, here's what we're going to do first week. And then the big thing was we kept it very confidential. Members of our caucus did not even know the plan until they got there on January 3rd.
In what way has the business of governing Kentucky changed besides this very productive legislative session? This is the short session.
Right, yeah.
Have there been a lot of accomplishments that could never have been done before obtaining majority control?
Yeah, I mean, you look at the issue of right to work, which has been critically important to Kentucky to allow us to compete with states like Tennessee and Indiana and you know, now even West Virginia and other states that have adopted right to work. That would have never been possible without a Republican majority. And we're already seeing the positive effects of that. The Amazon announcement in Northern Kentucky. While Amazon didn't say that right to work was the issue, what Amazon did say in making that huge announcement of 2,700 jobs and $1.5 billion investment, what they did say was they recognize the climate for business in Kentucky was changing, and that's what made Kentucky attractive. So I think we're already seeing the positive results of things like right to work and on repeal of prevailing wage. I know there are some universities that I have talked to have had projects that they're wanting to move forward on, capital construction, even some local school districts who have now, here in the last month, said, we're going to rebid some of these projects because we know now we can save money. So I think all of that has had a positive impact and will continue to have a positive impact. And those two things would have never been done without a Republican majority.
And the Speaker of the House, Jeff Hoover, of course, a Republican, the first Republican Speaker of the House in 96 years in Kentucky. This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. I'm John Hingsbergen, and we're interested in your reactions to the 2017 General Assembly. As a voter, did the House and the Senate, along with the governor, do what you were hoping they would do this year? This was what they call a short session. And there was an awful lot of work accomplished for a short session. We have our reporters with us, Adam Beam of the Associated Press, Ronnie Ellis of CNHI Newspapers, and Ryland Barton of Kentucky Public Radio in the studio with us. You're welcome to interact with them with your questions or your comments about this General Assembly session. And we're going to get to the phone in just a quick moment here. We have a couple of emails and some other messages here. We want to get our listeners involved in the conversation. But, gentlemen, your interaction with the public and your reporting on the General Assembly, what are you hearing from the public regarding the accomplishments, if that is the correct term, of the this General Assembly session? And Speaker Hoover, very proud of what they have accomplished during this session.
I mean, it's a very divided political climate out there right now. I think run into a whole lot of people who are angry about the legislature's having passed the anti-abortion bills. There's a new law requiring or forbidding abortions after the 20th week in pregnancy. Another one requiring ultrasounds to be conducted on women seeking, about to get an abortion and have the doctor describe that ultrasound to the woman. There's a lot of people who are angry about that. There's a lot of people who are really happy about that, too. People have really rallied behind these political causes for a long time. And I think in Kentucky, we're a conservative state, but we're also a state that has, there's some pretty deep liberal areas as well. And because of the nature of this urban-rural divide, we have a very interesting way that laws get made in Kentucky.
I still find that most people don't realize what the General Assembly is and what they do. And a lot of times they confuse their state lawmakers with their federal lawmakers. So with that said, I still don't think a lot of people in Kentucky know what all the General Assembly has done this session. But I think there are two bills that the Republicans passed this year that could hurt them because it could a lot of people do know about them. The first is charter schools. I hear a lot of people, even people that I know personally who don't follow the legislature that closely, including my wife. She knew a lot about the charter schools bill, as a lot of people did, and a lot of people had very strong opinions about it. And that was something that it took Republicans a long time to get enough votes to pass that. I'm really interested to see once these schools start being created and the impact that they have, what kind of repercussions that's going to have politically. The second one is a more obscure bill, but it was very difficult to pass. It has to do with zoning decisions. And if there's a Walmart coming or some store, some big development coming, and you don't like it, you can, challenge the zoning board decision to allow it to happen. And this law that was passed basically said you're going to have to, if you want to appeal it pretty farther beyond just the first appeal, you're going to have to put up an appeal bond. And it's going to cost a lot of money, and it's going to make it more difficult to appeal some of these decisions. And as they were voting on that, they called for the vote. They didn't have the votes to pass it. And then as they were talking about it, you could almost see the arms being twisted, and they had the votes. And so I'm wondering if that one might come back to haunt Republicans later. As more people discover what these bills mean, are they're going to be upset and they're going to call, you know, turn to the legislature then.
That's one a lot of us have not focused on or thought about. I mean, on the charter schools issue, Ronnie Ellis, Ryland talking about the urban-rural divide in Kentucky, the charter schools aren't going to happen in very tiny towns, are they?
Well, we don't know. That was kind of part of the debate on the floor. But there were some folks who stood up and said, you know, you're going to vote for this because you don't think it's going to affect your community, but it very well may. You know, that was another one of those that I, from a political perspective, I found real fascinating as it played out. There were a number of people in the Republican House caucus, particularly rural legislators, who were not particularly enthusiastic about that bill, but went ahead and voted for it. And, of course, the fellow who sponsored the bill and chairs the Education Committee in the House is a public school teacher. And he has run into some rough waters back home, I believe. So I'm with Adam. I think that's one that will be interesting to see what the reaction is. And the second one he mentioned plays into that populist piece that was so effective for Trump. That really is the corporate interest against the little guy. So we'll see how that one plays out.
Let's go to the phone and talk to Lee from Lawrenceburg. Lee, thank you for waiting on the line. You are on the air. Go right ahead.
I'm curious to know whether any of the gentlemen speaking have any idea why Senate Bill 7 did not pass.
What was Senate Bill 7? Help us out. We're all fatigued.
It called constitutional carry. It would ensure that law-abiding adults in Kentucky who may legally own a firearm may legally carry it concealed without having to pay the state for a license.
That is a great question. You know, I remember when the after the first week when we passed all those bills, I did a story about, you know, what's coming up the rest of the session. And I interviewed some Republican lawmakers, and they mentioned that bill and said that was one of the ones they were going to pass. But, you know, when they came back, I never heard one discussion, nobody talk about it. I don't think it ever even got a committee hearing anywhere. So I don't know why that is. I mean, it could be that they just got so focused on passing charter schools and all these other bills that they just didn't have time to get around to it, and maybe they're going to come back to it. Or there might have been some other forces at work there. I'm not sure.
Well, and I do think the leadership in the House, perhaps in the Senate as well, but certainly in the House, went out of its way to avoid some of the more contentious issues that might be debated lengthily on the floor. Because they knew it was a short session and they wanted to get these labor and abortion and charter school issues through that short session. So that may have played a part in it as well.
I mean, to what extent, and thank you, Lee, for that call. We do have a line open at 800-621-8890 if you'd like to get on board. To what extent, gentlemen, do you feel Republicans really were working to make sure they made a point? We're now in charge. We're going to pass laws. We're going to show that we had some accomplishments. Speaker Hoover actually openly acknowledged that in the conversation that he and I had. Was that pretty much underlying a lot of this? We don't want to get too deep, get into some of these complex, controversial issues, but just show accomplishment rather than get bogged down in a lot of dialogue and discussion.
I think that was a big part of what they were doing. I mean, pretty much every vote they took, that's what they said. We're making a statement. We're making a statement. And I, for one, was surprised at the cohesiveness that Republicans showed for the first couple of weeks. It wasn't until, I think, the very last couple of days where you started to see some evidence of some tension and some frayed relations there. But for the most part, they kind of operated with one voice there.
Well, I agree, except I think some of that was more of a public facade than in reality. I think
right.
We saw some of that on the charter school vote in the House when we had to have a caucus right before the vote, and there was some arm twisting. But without a doubt, I think that was the message that they intended to deliver and did in many ways deliver. If you will remember, before the session even began, Not only the Senate and House leadership, but the governor went out of their way to say they did not want to deal with things like the bathroom bill for transgender students and people. So I think there, without question, that was part of the deal. I think where the real test will come is when and if we have a special session on tax reform. Then we will see how united they are.
I think you saw a lot of that that Republican messaging coming in the through the timing of how some of these bills were taken up and how quickly some of them passed, especially at the beginning of the legislative session. Like Speaker Hoover mentioned, you know, they kept it under wraps, but everybody kind of knew that these were going to happen. And then once the legislature opens up, they hit the road and they pass them as quickly as they could. At the same time, I think you could also see that in some of the bills that were proposed and moved along but never ultimately passed, like the Attorney General bill that we saw. You know, Republicans were kind of showing that, okay, you know, we're not happy with the way the Democratic Attorney General's been acting, and we could do this. We have we very well have the power to do this. Didn't end up passing, and I think that probably because it looked so overtly political. But you could also see that with the neighborhood schools bill. This is something that's passed out of the Senate repeatedly. This is something that would have allowed students, no matter the way that local school boards structure their school assignments, it would have allowed students to attend the school that's geographically nearest to them. So this would have really affected Louisville for in the biggest way. And you know, Republicans in Louisville haven't liked the way their basically desegregation policy is structured, that students would, are kind of bussed in from remote parts of the county to create more integrated schools. And so Republicans were showing, listen, like, remember this issue that we have passed repeatedly? It's still around, and we could pass it, but they didn't. They didn't go all the way. And I think that there were several other bills dealing with Louisville that were kind of like that. It was like, almost threatening this very solidly Democratic bunch of blocks.
Is there anything else like that regarding the school preference bill? Is that happening anywhere else in the country? That seems kind of a surprise. This kind of a reverting, 50 years to the busing situation of the 1960s and the civil rights movement.
No, not really. I mean, part of it's because Louisville's desegregation policy it was released from federal requirements that it, desegregated schools in like the year 2000. But it's decided to keep going with this, saying that it's important. But from what I can tell, that this isn't something that's really happening in other parts of the country.
If you're on the line, stay there. We're going to get to you, especially we know Tyler from Lexington is on the line. We hope to get to you shortly. Feel free to jump on board and be part of today's Eastern Standard, our reporters roundtable discussing the 2017 General Assembly. 800-621-8890. Send us a note by email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com, or send a tweet at wekuest. This is Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. This week, a reporters roundtable, and our group of Adam Beam from the Associated Press, Ronnie Ellis of CNHI Newspapers, including the Richmond Register, and Ryland Barton of Kentucky Public Radio with us in the studio. And they're glad to hear from you with your questions, your comments, reactions to the 2017 General Assembly. 800-621-8890. Write to us by email, wekueasternstandard@gmail.com. Let me acknowledge an email or two here and see if we can give it a response, and then we'll get to the phone line. This one came in from Colleen regarding the Blue Lives Matter. Essentially, this was made, and this was passed, a bill that made attack on law enforcement and emergency personnel a hate crime. She writes, what impact might there be with the above law if another shooting occurs in the community between a police officer and a community member and protests ensue? Will the law impact the tolerance police and safety officers have for protesters?
I think the worry among protesters that this would affect them is that if they were to attack a police officer, that could then be considered to be a hate crime. And what that does is it affects kind of the sentencing, like the parole. There'd be a certain amount of your sentence that you would have to serve, and the judge would be able to take that into consideration when sentencing you. And also I believe the probation board, once you're finishing your sentence, would be able to consider it once you're leaving.
One thing to keep in mind about that bill is I feel like a lot of people think that, now, anytime there's any type of assault or you shove a police officer, you're going to be charged with a hate crime. This is something that has to be litigated. So, yeah, I mean, there's going to be an initial charge. You'll be taken to the, you know, arrested and charged. And then in the court system, if they want to pursue this hate crime, they're going to have to convince a judge that you meet the requirements for this legislation. They've got to present evidence that shows that you deliberately targeted a police officer solely for the reason that they are a police officer. And I think that offers some protections from this being abused, but who knows? I mean, we might see it put in place. There was a police officer who was hit by a car in Louisville who died, right, recently. I might remember getting some of the facts wrong just recently in the last week of the session. And so people have been wondering maybe this statute could be tested this time around if they can prove that this person who was charged deliberately targeted the police officer.
Was that term actually used in the legislation, hate crime?
Yes, it actually amends the state's hate crime statute.
Now, does it vary from, doesn't hate crime pretty much stem from federal government?
There's a state law that describes what hate crimes are, and it previously applied to crime, and it's a certain set of crimes. It's like seven or eight crimes, and you have to prove that they're targeted against a person based on their previously race, gender, and a couple other things, and now
characteristics emergency. My point was characteristics one could not change, one that are part integral
Correct.
To their person as opposed to their career.
Yeah, I think previously what you were talking about were classes of who you are, or rather what you are, rather than what you choose to do, is the distinction here that some of the opponents of the bill made on the floor.
And again, is this something that's happened anywhere else? Is Kentucky unique?
Louisiana passed a bill, I think it was last year they passed it, and there was another bill, another state that was considering it this year. I don't know if they passed yet.
Let's go back to the phone, line three, and we'll talk to Tyler from Lexington. If you're still on the line, Tyler, thanks for being there. Go right ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, y'all, and thanks for all the good reporting you've been doing this year.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So my question stems from there were several bills that were introduced this year around tax expenditures, creating more loopholes or handouts for certain corporations or industries, and it was said by legislative leadership that those matters would likely be taken up in a special session coming later this year. And that special session would be combined possibly with pension reform. And I was just wondering two things. One, if the reporters could comment on that special session, and then also just looking at the numbers for the sales base that is currently untaxed in our state, because the governor says he wants to broaden the sales tax base to include certain things. It seems that the largest sort of groups of goods that are currently untaxed are groceries and medicine, and from comments about wanting to move towards a Tennessee tax model, I was just wondering if y'all could comment on if you think that groceries and medicines will end up being on the table for taxation in this upcoming special session.
All right, Tyler, thank you for that question.
Well, I mean, it depends on what you mean on the table. I think probably it'll at least be up for discussion. I think politically that'd be a very difficult thing to do. Of course, I think it's going to be politically difficult to do it at all. I believe my numbers are approximate, but I believe our annual general fund budget is about $10.5 billion, and the estimation is that we leave about $13 or $14 billion in untaxed through various loopholes, not just the sales tax, but also incentives that have been applied. But you're correct. The majority of that is food and medicine. Governor Bevin definitely wants to look at the loopholes. That's been something that's been pushed from both sides of the aisle for some years, but never had enough support. And he also wants to lower, whereas some lawmakers would like to eliminate corporate and individual income taxes. There are some calculations which indicate you can spread the sales tax to services at a lower than the current 6% rate and still reduce or eliminate income taxes. The proof will be in the pudding, but those studies are out there.
That would set up a two-tiered income or a sales tax system?
Well, I don't know about what you mean by two-tier. No, what I'm saying
if the rate,
is...
If the rate were different for service versus...
No, that's not what I meant to say. There are people who believe that by expanding what sales taxes are applied to, that you can lower the rate from 6 to
lower it for everyone.
And
okay,
still bring in more revenue while at the same time reducing income taxes. Now, there's some people who dispute that, especially depending on what you do with food and medicine. The bigger problem, I think, is going to be 23 new first-term House Republicans voting for anything that can be characterized as a sales tax.
That's exactly right.
A tax increase.
Because if tax reform was purely a Republican and Democrat issue, we'd have done tax reform a long time ago. But it's not. I think it's mostly a geographic issue, because instead of having Republicans versus Democrats, you have Lexington versus Louisville versus Paducah versus Ashland versus Pikeville versus, you know, and all these different regions of the state have very different interests, and people can't agree on it. And that's why I don't think a special session is 100% guarantee at the moment, because they're not going to call it unless they have a deal. And every time we ask these leaders what's going on with tax reform, they say, oh, we haven't even started talking about it yet. So
I think there's real reluctance in the House to take this on. I really do. The chairman of the Budget Committee is supposed to be on a working group meeting with the governor's staff. The last time I spoke with Steve Rudy, he didn't have much to say about anything that had been accomplished or discussed. Speaker Hoover has always spoken with some hesitation about it. And if you talk to some of those rank-and-file members, they just don't want to talk about the subject if they can avoid it.
Here's an email from listener Guy from Berea. He says, what is the appropriate sentence for someone convicted of an abortion? Is it considered homicide? Life imprisonment? Is the father of the child also guilty if he approves? What is the penalty for assisting in an abortion? And I guess this would apply to abortions after the 20-week limit that was now put in place?
Yeah, I can't remember exactly what the sentence was for that, because that was passed back in early January. This is the ban on abortions during or after the 20th week in pregnancy. And I believe the crime would actually be against the doctor who conducts the abortion. I'm not sure if it was a felony or what.
I'm not sure there's actual time involved. I mean, there's licensure implications and fines. But really, part of the reason for passing this is to facilitate the court test for Roe v. Wade. Part of the reason that we are in the Sixth Circuit, which is a more conservative circuit, and they're looking to get varying or different opinions out of multiple circuits to force it to go to the Supreme Court, which, of course, as they're debating in Washington as we speak, that court may shift a little bit soon.
Right, and the current parameter that's set by Roe v. Wade is that women have the right to an abortion. And I believe like the threshold is kind of set at the viability of the unborn fetus, and that viability level. First of all, it's not really set in by the court decision as a week, but 20 weeks seems like it's pretty clearly below the viability threshold. And so a law like this, feasibly could be challenged, and this could be one of the laws that ends up before the Supreme Court.
I've forgotten the state, but within the past 10 days. A similar bill has been ruled unconstitutional by a state court, not a federal court.
Will any of these abortion bills mean anything if the final clinic shuts down in Kentucky?
There are lawsuits over these very things, not necessarily the 20-week abortion ban, but there's one lawsuit over, that the state is trying to close one of the abortion clinics because saying that they don't have the proper agreements in place to transfer people to hospitals.
But those are the only places abortions are being
performed. Yeah, there's only one place, and it's in Louisville.
So if that clinic goes away, if a woman chooses to go to another state for an abortion, these laws don't apply.
I'm trying to look up what the penalty would be, and I'm having trouble finding it. But I did see in this bill that the doctor who's performed it would basically lose their medical license. That would be one penalty, so you couldn't be a doctor anymore. But there are criminal penalties. I can't figure out what they are yet at the moment.
Let's go back to the phone and talk to Bill from Richmond. Bill, thank you for staying on the line with us. Go right ahead.
Yes, this is Bill Carey. Are you hearing me?
We're hearing you, Bill. Go right ahead.
I'm excited to be a caller and a semi-informed public is what I am. But I noticed, I read in the Richmond Register, I'm in Richmond, Kentucky, about the governor vetoed some bills. And I find this, I don't know the governor very well. He seems to me, in some respects, quite a bit like the president. And I'm guesstimating, I looked at the bills that were vetoed, and then they were the veto was overridden. So it looked like they were the governor might have thought they were inconsequential. But then I was surprised that the override, the vote, the legislator voted, in some cases, was zero against to override. And so I'd like to hear a little bit about that situation.
Yeah, I mean, it was a little bit surprising. The leaders of both chambers said that it was, you know, a little tough going against the governor, especially one who has campaigned on their members' behalfs over the past year, especially on the House side, helping elect a new class of mostly Republican lawmakers over there. But at the same time, I think that they were happy to exercise their legislative independence. Another thing is that it's very easy to override vetoes in Kentucky as long as, you know, one party has control of both legislative chambers. All you have to do is get a constitutional majority
simple
vote.
Majority.
A simple majority. So 51 votes in the 100-member House and 20 votes in the 38-member Senate. So you essentially just have to kind of pass the bill again. And so really the risk is political. You're going against your governor. But I think that they were pretty quickly able to get over that and decide that they wanted to show this feat of strength.
And all these bills that they overrode were not politically tough votes for anybody to take. So it was not politically tough for them to override it, I don't think. And plus, they kept pointing to it after the fact and saying, oh, look, we're not in the governor's pocket. Look, we overrode his veto. So they kind of like point to that. And I also wanted to point out, I did find, previous caller, the penalty for violating that abortion ban, Class D felony. Mm-hmm. So I think that's up to 5 years. That's the lowest felony charge. Yep. So you would be a felon, and you have to go to prison if you're convicted.
Lose your right to vote.
Okay. Bill, yep. Did you have a follow-up?
Well, I would agree if it had passed by 51 votes, that would make sense if there's 100 members. But they were passing by with zero opposing.
So your question is, why did the governor veto it?
Well, in part, why did he veto it? And then I was amazed, as I say, the unity of the legislature in overriding.
Well, he vetoed each bill individually for different reasons. I think what it came down to, for example, I know the mental health law, he was concerned that it was going to violate people's personal freedoms. So I think he vetoed them for philosophical reasons himself. And, you know, again, the Republicans... And why they were so unified against him, I think they liked it because it was their ability to say, the common charge from Democrats is, oh, you just do whatever the governor tells you. And they were able to say, no, we don't, you know, because we overrode his veto on these bills that weren't that politically
without
tough for
us. Without a huge political risk.
Yeah. Bill, thanks again for your call. One final question. I was wondering if you all, our reporters, Rylan Barton, Ronnie Ellis, and Adam Beam, what is this $15 million mystery project? The bill that would the lawmakers voted to set aside $15 million in bonds so because the governor has a project waiting out there that he wants to bring into the state.
Well, nobody's saying. I mean, all we know is that it's $15 million from the state side, but this mystery company will be investing probably up to, I think it was $1.3 billion, 500 full-time jobs with an average salary of $75,000 a year, and then an additional 1,000 construction jobs. So it sounds like a pretty monumental investment. investment. And it would put on top of that, it would be in Eastern Kentucky, which everybody's been trying to figure out how to help Eastern Kentucky. So this could be a significantly huge moment for Eastern Kentucky. We just have no idea what it is. We were joking beforehand that maybe it was some like natural gas development and then Eastern Kentucky would hate it because it would be getting rid of coal jobs. But who knows? I mean, nobody knows.
Well, and there may have been some indication that that evening on the floor as to what part of Eastern Kentucky, given that the minority leader spoke very much in favor of this. He's from Moorhead and Elliott County area. And then the Republican lawmaker who spoke rather vigorously in support of this is from Carter County, Jill York. So it may be up in the northeastern end of the state.
Mm-hmm. But we'll wait to hear some news on that, I guess. I guess we'll be hearing from the governor when that occurs. Now, what about the special session for tax reform? You're speculating that it may or may not happen, but we've heard that it could happen late summer, early fall.
Yeah, nobody's got a definite answer on that. When you ask people when would it happen, they're thinking, you know, maybe once the school year starts, people's summer breaks are over. But again, we don't know if this is going to happen. It's very politically fraught right now because the governor suggested in his State of the Commonwealth address that he might want to find some new revenue for the state because the state's got huge pension problems. As soon as he said that, you know, that leads people to think, wait, does that mean a tax increase? Does that mean getting rid of some of these tax breaks for people that are very popular? And so it's very politically fraught right now. We don't know if it's going to happen, but
definitely,
it's up to the governor.
Definitely not in the summer. It'll probably be the fall. I have some vacation scheduled first part of October. I guarantee you that.
Adam's got
happens.
Clout.
All right. Adam Beam, Ryland Barton, Ronnie Ellis, thank you all, as always, for being here. And if that special session is declared, and we know it's going to happen, we'll get you guys in here, perhaps for some other reason before then as well, but really appreciate this opportunity to interact with reporters covering the Kentucky's General Assembly and Kentucky government. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, John. Thank you.
Thank you to Devonna Gaines and Marissa Hempel, our associate producers. Thank you to Brian Bartlett for being at the controls for this week's Eastern Standard. We're always interested in hearing from you. WEKU Eastern Standard at gmail.com. Send us a tweet. Follow us on Twitter at WEKU EST. The show repeats on Sunday evening at 6 o'clock, and of course we'll be available for online listening and as a podcast sometime this afternoon. For Eastern Standard and WEKU, I'm John Hingsbergen. Thanks for tuning in.